We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is at the controls. From time to time on the program, we have physicians here to talk about various things. We have a family practice doctor who's here every other month. We have an OBGYN. We have people who have special areas of practice. And we try to talk about different parts of the body. Different special interests. This time around, we'll be talking about men's health, something that we try to do at least once a year or so, to talk about issues like prostate cancer. Maybe we talk about some of the things that have to do with sexual function. Maybe there's some more general things that have to do with men and their health. And if you have questions, now is the time to pick up the phone and give us a call. Our guest is Dr. Ron Conchanan. He is a urologist with the Carl Physician Group in Urbana. And we're glad that he could be here in the studio to answer questions. We're going to open it up, and whatever's on your mind, you can give us a call whenever we have physicians on the program. I do try to remind people who are listening that because this is a phone conversation, we can't diagnose over the phone. But we do these programs, we hope, to help you out, to give you a place to start, maybe ask some basic questions. And so please do that, and I know the doctor will do his best to answer the question, and, mm-hmm. and then you may need to go on and pursue it with someone who can see you. But this is a good place to start. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For being here. I thought maybe we might talk a little bit about testosterone. As I've done some reading about issues involving testosterone, and particularly the idea that maybe for some men, as they get older and as their testosterone level drops, which I guess is a normal thing to have happen.
True.
Now, there is some thought that maybe if men are having problems sexual functioning, maybe some mood issues, maybe just general, you know, feeling like they just don't have the physical stamina that they did, that might have something to do with testosterone. Now, I guess it gets sort of more complicated because if you measure their testosterone levels and then you compare it to men of the same age who say, oh, I'm not having any problem, there's not a whole lot of difference. What can you say about testosterone?
What you say is true, that if you have a gentleman with a low testosterone level, he can feel, have some sexual difficulties, feel fatigued, tired, just not like he did years and years and years ago. Testosterone is such a really weird blood test. You know, everything hangs on, okay, well, what's your testosterone level? The level has to be drawn first thing in the morning because testosterone peaks early, 7, 8 a.m., and then the level trails off during the day. Mm-hmm. So you can have a normal testosterone level if you measure your peak, but if you draw the blood test at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it may be low. So the first thing that we always do when we see a patient who says, okay, my testosterone level is whatever, is when was it drawn? And make sure it's drawn first thing in the morning because you can just, you know, go down a false road chasing testosterone all over the place. So that's the first thing. If the morning testosterone is low, then we usually go and do a little bit more testing, such as getting a free and weakly bound testosterone, sex hormone binding globulin level, luteinizing hormone, sort of the supporting enzymes around that to see what's going on. And if those check out low and the gentleman is symptomatic, then he would be a candidate for a testosterone replacement. Now, testosterone replacement is controversial too, mm-hmm. that just like estrogen replacement in women with a history or family history of breast cancer, prostate cancer is certainly known to grow in a testosterone environment. And there are some that fear, okay, testosterone is just pouring gasoline on perhaps a smolding ember and creating a fire. I'm going to go on a limb and tell you my feeling of testosterone. I don't think that hormones cause cancer. I don't think that estrogen causes breast cancer. I don't think that testosterone causes prostate cancer. There's no doubt about it that they do nourish the environment. And you have to, if you're going to put a guy on testosterone replacement, you have to monitor his prostate health, monitor his PSA, do rectal examination. In other words, it's not just here, take testosterone and okay, you're good to go. You do have to watch out for that, because if he did have a small tumor that was developing but not clinically manifest yet, We may be feeding that.
Hmm. Well, is it the case, as I've gotten this impression, and you tell me whether it's true or not, say you take two guys, you measure their testosterone, do it at the same time of day, so you're fairly confident you got a good reading,
mm-hmm.
and they're the same age, and you ask one guy, well, you know, how are you doing? And he says, well, I think for a man my age, I'm doing okay. You don't have any major complaints. And you ask the other guy, and the guy says, Doc, I'm tired all the time. I just don't have very much energy. I just feel kind of depressed, you know, and I would like to be sexually active, but I'm having some difficulties there. So you have two men that seem to be comparable. Their testosterone level seems to be comparable. But in one case, you have these symptoms, and in the others, you don't. Assuming that you can have a case, you know, have two guys like that, what do you think accounts for the difference? Or maybe there is a little bit of difference between the two of them, but you'd look at the numbers and say, well, it's not very big, so that you don't feel like that's a very good explanation.
Well, I think it's just like anything else. You know, you can take two guys in any other thing, and one guy's got a positive attitude. I feel great. I feel terrific. Everything's wonderful, and I'm steaming right ahead. And the other guy is, I'm bad. But I think, I think if the gentleman is symptomatic and has a low testosterone, then okay, that fits into the hypogonadism thing. And focusing on a low number on a guy who's asymptomatic, I'd probably be inclined to watch that guy.
Okay. And so there's really nobody is talking about there being some kind of benefit. Now, of course, there are a lot of questions about hormonal replacement for women. But it sounds like nobody has really ever come along and said, well, there might be some kind of benefit by having a fairly broad-based hormonal replacement in men.
Let's see. The guys at from New Jersey did a study on gentlemen who were not responding to Viagra, and they looked at their testosterone level, mm-hmm. and they said if their level was low or just low normal, that they could increase the response rate to Viagra by supplementing testosterone. So that's the first. You know, these guys were not really complaining of the full blown hypogonadism syndrome. Oh, I'm tired. I'm fatigued. And my mood is awful.
Mm-hmm.
These were just guys who they went to see their family doctor. Here's some Viagra. You know, it didn't work that well for me. So then they go see the urologist. The urologist checks the testosterone level. It's low normal. Let's try to boost your testosterone. The response rate increases.
And does it take very much testosterone to make a difference?
Not much on those guys. You know, they're not rock bottom. So you're just trying to boost them up a little bit and get them a little bit higher into the normal range.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Ronald Conchanan. He is a urologist with Carl in Urbana, and we're talking about men's health. And if you have specific kind of questions that deals with this area of practice or generally with men and their health, you can give us a call, and the doctor will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And you can send along your questions by email if you want to do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller in Champaign. Let's go right there. Line one.
Hi.
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 Hi. I've got a question about I've got a question about kidney stones.
Okay.
And I have a kind of a three-part question. One, can kidney stones go away by themselves? Two, how can you tell? And three, if you haven't been able to collect it, is there any blood test or something that you can use to determine how they form or whether you have any in you now?
All right. Do kidney stones go away spontaneously? Aside from passing them, no. There's a small percentage of kidney stones are uric acid stones, and those stones are dissolvable. If you put the patient, if you alkalize the patient's urine, you can dissolve those stones. 85% of stones are calcium oxalate, and those are rocks that are not going to dissolve. The second question was
about blood tests. How you're able to. Is there any blood test that can tell you if you're likely to form stones or in one of the types that you just described?
Well, nothing, you know, there's nothing that beats a stone analysis to say, okay, your stone was a calcium stone or your stone was a uric acid stone. Blood tests, it's nice to know a serum calcium level to make sure that you're not don't have too much calcium in the blood for someone who is hyperparathyroid, where they have a parathyroid that makes hormone which raises their serum calcium. So a serum calcium is nice. The other test that we like is a 24-hour urine stone panel where you collect the urine for 24 hours and you send it for calcium oxalate, citrate, uric acid, sodium, potassium, and you can see what the urine environment looks like.
Okay.
And there's a line in one of the urology textbooks that says when you really come to think of it, it's not amazing that someone gets a stone. What's amazing is that more people don't.
Oh.
And we don't understand fully all the chemistry of why does this patient who has a normal calcium and has a normal uric acid and has a normal oxalate, why does that patient keep forming stones? And why does this one who has an elevated urine calcium not form a stone? But those are the best tests that we have today.
Does diet influence the formation of stones?
It may. For example, if one is predisposed to calcium oxalate stones, a diet high in oxalate, very, very high in oxalate, green leafy vegetables, peanuts, chocolate, those things are high in oxalate. And if a patient, in my practice, I see that a lot with people who are really, really avid nut eaters. They'll have peanut butter sandwich for lunch and then you know, a snack of nuts before dinner and then eat dinner and then have more nuts afterwards. Those guys can really drive their oxalate levels up and drive stone formation through oxalate.
You've named all my favorite foods.
Well, and everyone says, oh, but green leafy vegetables, that's supposed to be so healthy for you. I'm not saying don't eat green leafy vegetables, but if one's prone to that, then that's a good thing. Get the stone analysis and see what's my oxalate level. Oh, on my standard diet, my oxalate level is 30, where normal is up to 40. Then I'm good. But hey, look, this is my normal diet, and wow, my oxalate level is 52. Maybe I do need to cut down on the peanuts a little bit.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right,
you're welcome.
Well, this is something that I've wondered a little bit about in connection with calcium supplementation. Because this is particularly an issue with women. We're saying to women for their bone health, we want to make sure you get plenty of calcium. Osteoporosis is a real problem in postmenopausal women. So it is also a problem in men, although it's not to the same degree. Mm-hmm. But if you were supplementing calcium, you want to make sure that you've got plenty of calcium. Can that actually be a problem?
For most people, no. And there's a cute study that was done. This group took recurrent stone formers. And in group A, they said, no calcium for you, no cheese, no milk, no calcium supplements. In group B, they said, sure, milk, cheese, calcium supplements, anything you want. And they looked at which group formed more stones. And logic would tell you, oh, the ones that took calcium formed more stones. Yeah. But the answer is the group that was calcium restricted had more stones.
Doesn't make any sense.
It does make sense.
Oh, okay.
It does make sense. Calcium oxalate, when calcium binds to oxalate, it forms a crystal. Mm-hmm. And that makes oxalate unabsorbable in the intestine. So the body cannot absorb that much oxalate. So if you restrict the calcium, then the oxalate is sitting in the intestine. The intestine says, hey, look at this stuff. Let's absorb it and throw it in the bloodstream. Then the kidney says, wait a minute, we don't need all this stuff. Let's dump it in the urine. And the oxalate level in the urine goes up. And you drive stone formation by having extra oxalate in the urine. If you take calcium, then the calcium binds the oxalate and the crystals pass out and you don't hyperabsorb the oxalate.
Okay.
There's a small percentage of people that does not work in that will hyperabsorb the calcium, but that's a small percentage. So as a rough rule of thumb, calcium restriction is not recommended for stone formers.
All right. Let's talk with some other folks here. Effingham County here, line number 4. That's the next.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yes. I would like to ask about, you're talking about kidneys. What about those cysts that's on them? Are they anything to be worried about?
Cysts of the kidney are very common. 50% of people over 40, if you did an ultrasound or a CAT scan, would have a cyst on the kidney. There are different type cysts. Bosniak is a radiologist, and he spent his career categorizing cysts. And if everything meets the criteria for a simple cyst, then we don't need any follow-up. That means it's nice and round. The wall is thin. There's no walls in the middle of the cyst. It's not got some kind of glop in it, like blood or what have you. And it has a sharp demarcation from the kidney. If there's one abnormality, then that's a Bosniak type 2 cyst, where we should watch that cyst and make sure that nothing's changing with it. And if the cyst is very, very weird, it's got a thick wall or there's multiple abnormalities, it's got debris floating in it, there's inner walls in the cyst, then that cyst probably needs to be explored. But that's the vast minority. Most cysts are benign things that just are noted on X-ray studies, and if everyone says, yep, that's a simple cyst, then we don't need to really worry about that.
Okay, I had one other question, mm-hmm. and I'll take the answer on off the phone. What about the spleen? What's the function of the spleen? Thank you.
Well, the spleen to the urologist just gets in the way when he's trying to do surgery, but the spleen is supposed to trap old red blood cells and take them out of circulation and break them down.
All right. We'll go on to another caller. Sullivan, line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, I got a question.
Sure.
I take Flomax, and I had a blood withdrawn for PSA, and it was something like 5.7 or whatever, and he said 6 was the maximum. What does he mean by that?
The PSA we're talking about?
Yes.
Well, okay, PSA. PSA, first of all, just to give a little background, is a blood test. It's an enzyme that's made by the prostate and only by the prostate. And if the prostate gets infected, irritated, in a period of prosthetic growth or has a malignancy in it, then the prostate can release more of this PSA into the bloodstream. So a rising PSA suggests that something is going on with the prostate. It doesn't mean that you have prostate cancer, one thing or the other. That's for the urologist to sort out. But PSA is kind of a a barometer of, hey, something may be happening with the prostate here.
Okay. He said if it got up to 6, he'd be concerned. You know, what type of concerns would he have at that point in time?
Well, obviously, the list that I mentioned, the thing that everyone fears the most would be prostate cancer. So a rising PSA might suggest that the possibility of prostate cancer being present, and that would lead us to say, well, let's examine the prostate, let's repeat the PSA. Do we want to do a free and total PSA? What's the trend in the PSA? What were the previous values? If the PSA has been fairly stable but just slowly inching up, we might just say, hey, that's just natural progression, and just leave that alone. Is the PSA a wild spike up? If it's been 2 and it goes up to 6, that's kind of a wild bump, and that may be just a spike in the PSA. Unfortunately, PSA is not a perfect blood test, and we can see these spikes where patient's baseline is 2, then he's up to 6. If you repeat the PSA, boom, comes right back down again in 75% of the cases.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. Well, this is an area I wanted to make sure we got into, because it's something that I'm sure a lot of guys are confused about. And if you read from time to time stories about prostate cancer and PSA testing, there seems to be some, I don't want to say controversy, maybe some disagreement about what good it is, and then based on the number, then what you decide to go do from there. But basically now, are you still recommending, generally is the recommendation that all men should start having their PSA checked, and should have it checked every year at 50?
50.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. I said before, PSA is not a perfect blood test. In the perfect world, there would be a test that would be only positive or only elevated in the presence of prostate cancer. And unfortunately, in medicine, there is not that test. There are blood tests that can measure for certain cancers, CA-125 for ovarian cancer, CEA for colon cancer, PSA for prostate cancer. None of those is spectacular, because other things can interfere and make the test get elevated. So the question is there anything better than PSA? And the answer is no. I mean, we have rectal examination, which goes hand in hand with PSA, but there's really no other test that can be used simply and easily to help in the detection of prostate cancer. So we have to deal with, okay, we've got PSA. It definitely can identify men who have clinically significant prostate cancer that don't have any palpable abnormalities of the prostate. But not every man with an elevated PSA has prostate cancer. Or the way I like to think about it, if a urologist is sitting in his office and says, I want to diagnose prostate cancer, how can he do it? Well, he can say, well, every male who comes in over 50 is going to get a prostate biopsy, and then I will find everyone with prostate cancer in my practice. Or he can recommend PSA. Now, if you have an elevated PSA, the chance of having a biopsy which shows prostate cancer is about 25%. So the way I see PSA is, it takes a large group of men that are at risk for biopsy, and it shrinks it down to, hey, if I want to find prostate cancer and I've got this group of elevated PSAs, 1 in 4 in that group is going to have prostate cancer. So it spares many from having a prostate biopsy. It doesn't spare everyone from having a prostate biopsy. Mm-hmm. So it's a good step in the right direction, but it's not perfect.
Other than prostate cancer, what things can lead to an elevated PSA?
Well, just the prostate is growing. If the prostate's in a growth spell, the PSA can go up. prostate infection or bladder infection can make the PSA grow up. Chronic prostatitis, prostate irritation. Having a catheter placed for surgery, having a urinary catheter placed through the prostate into the bladder irritates the prostate a little bit, can make the PSA go up if PSA is drawn shortly after that. A vigorous rectal examination can make the PSA go up. So, and then there's the group that, hey, my PSA just spiked on its own and it just did it.
Right. And so the idea here is in having that first test and having annual testing, what you want is to have a baseline, and then what you want is to be able to look at it over time so that you can see, yeah, is it constant? Does it go up? Oh, maybe a little bit. The thing you really are concerned about is if it was, you know, maybe relatively low over a number of period of years, and then suddenly it goes way up. That would at least make you say, okay, come back. We want to do this test again.
Exactly. There are two ways. There's two ways to look at PSA. One is you draw a line in the sand and you say this is the upper limit of normal. And if your PSA is over that line, then okay, boom, that raises the red flag. And the other is, as you said, what's the change in PSA? If your PSA has always been 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, and now it's 4 this year, even though you may say, well, that's below the magic line there, the change in PSA from 1 to 4 over 1 year's time is a significant change, and that would cause further investigation.
You'd want to know why.
Yes.
Why is that?
Yes.
All right. And what is there is a magic line where you'd say at this number of, or above, if you get a PSA like that, then I'm really concerned.
Well, some labs use a straight cutoff the upper limit of normal for PSA is 4, and other hospitals, including Carl, use an age-adjusted PSA. So the upper limit of normal for someone in their 40s would be 2.5, and then someone in their 50s is 3.5, and someone 60s and 70s goes up to 6.5. So we allow the older guys, if I can use that term, to have a slightly higher PSA. But we also get more nervous about a 45-year-old who presents with a PSA of 2.8, for example, because he should be way under 2.5.
Yeah, okay. And so it is natural to see some increase in PSA, and that is sounds like it's probably mostly related to natural, benign enlargement of the prostate that just happens. It happens as you get older.
Yes. The prostate does enlarge with age, and as cells grow, there's more cells. They make more PSA. So we expect a little creep up in PSA over time.
Okay. Another caller here in Urbana. Let's go there. Line one. Hello.
Is there an age beyond which you would not continue having PSA tested?
That's a very good question. Yes, but that depends on the physician and the patient. PSA can help in the early detection of prostate cancer. For example, if we have a guy in his 50s and he presents with an elevated PSA and we find that he does have prostate cancer, a study was done in the Scandinavian countries where those guys were watched, and at 10 years, most of them were still alive, didn't die of prostate cancer. So the initial conclusion from the study was, hey, we don't need to treat prostate cancer because, look, in 10 years, these guys are still alive. But they went back to look at the 20-year survival data, and they found out that the results were dismal and that most had died of disease in 12 to 15 years. So it seems, okay, if most of these guys were diagnosed with prostate cancer at this age, 12 to 15 years later, they die of prostate cancer. So that's kind of the ballpark thing. So if we have a gentleman in his early 80s, and doesn't have a family history where everyone in his family has lived to 120, then it may be less important to find out in him whether he has a tiny little prostate cancer, because even if he did and we left it alone, the likelihood is he might die of natural causes or other causes before prostate cancer ever kicked in. So the recommendations sort of the AUA, American Urological Association, says 50 to 70. 70 above, discuss it with your patient. I still think that for many 70-year-olds, I still do PSAs. I really don't like to get caught up in the PSA thing in gentlemen after 80 years of age.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Just the going to this question of do you do PSA testing and is it worth it? I think that there are some people make the argument that by testing everybody, regardless of their family history and what you think that their risk is, that you're going to get some tests are going to come back with elevated PSA, and you're going to say, okay, this concerns me, and you're going to do follow up. And I suppose in some of those guys, then you will end up doing a biopsy, mm-hmm. because that's the only real way to know. And so I guess some people think that maybe, though, that means we're doing some unnecessary – we're putting the guy through the stress, whatever risk is associated, and the cost. And in some of those, when we do the biopsies, they're going to come back negative, and we really didn't even need to be doing that. I mean, how do you think that we're doing a lot of unnecessary biopsies because we're doing the PSA testing?
Well, you know, we're still dealing with a lethal disease. Prostate cancer and lung cancer in men fight each other for which is going to be the leading killer of adult men with solid tumors. So we're dealing with either the number one or number two cancer cause of death in adult men. It's prostate cancer. It's nothing. I think it's important to find out who has prostate cancer. We don't have the magic test. We don't have the crystal ball that says, okay, you have prostate cancer, you have Gleason 7 disease, and you know, if you are not going to be treated, then this would be the cause of death in your life. Or the crystal ball that says you have Gleason 6 disease, and the crystal ball says you're going to get hit by a bus in 2 years, so live your life and don't have a biopsy. We don't have that. So in the absence of the perfect I can see into the future and predict who's going to do what, I think we're left with we have to try to identify those who have potential significant malignancies that can impact their life.
We're moving into about our last 15 minutes. Our guest is Dr. Ronald Conchanan. He's a urologist from Carl in Urbana. We're talking about men's health. And if you have questions about anything we've discussed so far or anything else that you think would fall into that big area, you can give us a call, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. He's a caller in Savoy, line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
The magic word, Gleason. I hear so much talk about the PSA, and almost no one talks about the Gleason score, which for someone with a cancer is probably the most important. Well, would you discuss that, please?
Sure. The Gleason score is the grade of the tumor, and roughly speaking, the worse it looks, the worse it behaves. Just like if you were walking down the street of some city and someone is walking towards you, you're trying to assess, well, what's my risk from this guy coming at me? Does he look like he's got a three-piece suit on and I don't think he's going to be a mugger? Or does he look like someone who's going to try to, beat me up? That's what the Gleason score does. The worse it looks, the worse it behaves. The worse it behaves, the greater the chance of having disease outside the prostate at the time diagnosis is made. Gleason 6, which is the average or typical prostate cancer, usually presents with a very, very small chance of disease outside the prosthetic capsule at the time of diagnosis, and that increases as the Gleason score goes up.
Do tumors ever change their Gleason rating?
Well, I'm not sure that they can change their tumor rating, but what might happen is we have a guy and we do a biopsy on him and we hit one area of tumor and say that all that the pathologist sees is 3. So he's going to call that a 3 plus a 3 because that's all he sees. And let's assume in reality that he has sort of a halo of 3 around maybe a core of 4, so that if the needle had been placed at a slightly different area, then we would have sampled 4. So that what can happen is, okay, the guy says, okay, I've got Gleason 6 disease and perhaps elect surgery. And then after surgery, the pathologists say, well, look at this. We looked at the whole specimen and we found out that there was more 4 in it than 3, or perhaps maybe just a little speck of 4 in it. And so the Gleason score on the final pathology is 7, whereas he thought he was a 6 going into surgery.
I see. Thank you.
All right. Thank
you.
There, I think that also there are a lot of questions about, once you make the determination of cancer, well, then what do you do? And that there seems to be a lot of evidence that once – if you tell a guy he's got cancer, a lot of guys are going to say, okay, fine, let's get it out of there. And that may indeed be the appropriate thing to do. The thing is that there also are implications of the treatment that can definitely have an impact on quality of life. And I think that there are some suggestion that maybe there ought to be a better way of deciding, do we do treatment right now and deal with this problem right now, or do we say, okay, this is not a real big cancer, it's not a real serious cancer, we know that it's a slow growing cancer, and so we could wait. I'm not saying you want to wait forever, but you could wait, and that probably would be okay. And you know, you don't deal with whatever negative side effects come with treatment. You know, how do you help somebody think about, do I get treatment right now, or do we say, okay, we'll just monitor this and we'll wait?
Well, that's a very good question. There's something called the Parton tables, where you look at what does the prostate feel like, what is the Gleason score on the biopsy, and what is the guy's PSA. And that will tell you this guy has a chance of organ-confined disease, such and such, extracapsular penetration, such and such, seminal vesicle invasion, such and such. For example, let's say we don't feel any abnormality on the prostate. The gentleman's PSA is 4.2 and he has Gleason 6 disease. Most people would say, gee, that's fairly favorable set of circumstances. He has an 80% chance that the cancer is confined to the prostate, which means that surgery, radiation, maybe even watching that guy for a while would do him well. He has, however, a 19% chance that the disease already is breaking outside the prostate and has extracapsular extension, so that the cancer is breaking out of the capsule of the prostate. And in that circumstance, if he had surgery, there's a chance of leaving a little speck of cancer behind. And he has a 1% chance, for those that have been counting. I had only 99%. The 1% chance that the cancer is already into the seminal vesicle. So the Parton tables help us, you know, tell the guy that even though you think these are wonderful, favorable circumstances, 19% already have extracapsular disease. And then it's up to the patient to decide, okay, well, do I want to wait or proceed with therapy. There's really no test for microscopic extracapsular disease. Mm. So, you know, maybe gross, if you had gross extension of the prostate, cancer outside, yeah, you could see that on the ultrasound when you did that or feel something. But we're talking about just microscopic capsular penetration. Very, very difficult to diagnose.
We have some callers. We'll try to get them all. Let's go next to Champagne. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like some information about bladder incontinence and bladder retention. Why does this happen, and what can be done about it? Thank you.
Sure. Okay.
Well, there's several different types of urinary incontinence, and they form the mnemonic device SCOUT, S-C-O-U-T. Stress incontinence means you leak urine when you cough, laugh, pick up something heavy. Continuous incontinence means that urine is just dripping out all the time, that the urethra basically is non-functioning. The urethra is the tube from the bladder to the outside. And that doesn't close tightly, so that urine just drips out constantly. Overflow incontinence occurs when the bladder is tremendously full and just physically can't take another drop in it, and so urine leaks out. Urge incontinence, the U, is I've got to go to the bathroom and I've got to go right now. Oops, I didn't make it. And it just started to come out before I could get there. And T stands for transient forms of incontinence, such as infection, diabetes out of control, and reduced mobility. If someone breaks his leg and can't physically get to the bathroom and depends on someone else to bring him a urinal and they're late arriving, he may just have incontinence that way. But in clinical practice, the stress, continuous overflow, and urge are the main ones that we see. Sometimes we can tell them apart by history. Other times we need a urodynamic test to see how the bladder is behaving and what form of incontinence the patient really has.
And are all these things treatable? But the treatment, I'm sure, would be different depending on what the cause is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
One of the things that we sort of said we were wanting to talk about men's health, and this can be a problem for both men and women, and under the heading of things guys don't like to talk about, it's my understanding that, in fact, almost one of every five men over 60 has some problem with urinary incontinence. I don't know if you would say yes, that you would agree with that figure, or no?
I think men can have some dribbling. That is a very, very common male complaint. So at the end of the stream, okay, we think we're done, and 3-4 drops come out, yes, that's incontinence, but that's more the shape of the urethra. Mm-hmm. Men with enlarging prostates can have urgency from that and can go into retention and can have overflow incontinence. So incontinence is an issue for both sexes.
Yeah, can men also have stress incontinence?
Usually the prostate helps that. If you take the prostate out, and guys who have had radical prostatectomy, then yes, they can have stress incontinence.
Okay. Effingham, next, line four. Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Yes, go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
I'm a current smoker, and I'm trying to quit, and I've been smoking for over 20 years, and along the way I found out some things about what smoking does, or at least I think it does, is it depletes vitamins in your system, and it causes a myriad of different problems, and I'm not much asking how to quit. I'm wondering, is there I read Popular Science magazine once in a while, and I heard about these two scientists that came up with a device that I guess they're for people who have fluid in their lungs that helps them get the fluid out, and they blow on it. I guess it's kind of similar to like a large gazoo or something, but it vibrates, I guess, a certain frequency helps with the hairs in the lungs to help move whatever it is out. And I'm wondering, since I'm trying to quit, and I'd like to have my lungs, pink shape, Is there a way of clearing out your lungs that way, with that device, and if there's a possibility of getting that? And would the vapors from vinegar help? Because I know that you can actually drink vinegar, and it's not, you know, it's not going to hurt you. At least I'm sure that not in large or not in small doses. That's about it. Thanks.
I'm going to have to defer that to my colleagues in pulmonary. Usually in urology, we try to stay below the diaphragm and not get into the lungs. So I'm not up to date on that one. I'm going to have to.
We'll have to defer. We have to get a lung guy in here.
Yes,
and defer to them. Sorry, all questions cannot be answered. Guests do their best, but our guest is a specialist in a particular area, and this is a little bit outside of that. So I'm sorry. That's probably about the best that we can do.
I would say briefly that cigarette smoking is associated with bladder cancer, and that's generally a bad thing. So I would urge those who are smokers to try to quit to decrease their risk for bladder cancer.
So there are good reasons to quit, and there are also various things, some prescription medications that are available to help. So that's something that somebody could always talk about with a doctor.
Right.
All right. To St. Joe here, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hi.
Yes. I hope you haven't touched on this before because I tuned in late, but I have a couple of questions and I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
I have kind of a high PSA, like a 3.3. And we've done a couple of biopsies and haven't found anything. And at what point do you decide, if you have a high PSA, do you wait a couple of years and keep testing if it stays level? And the other question I had was, sometimes he'll do a regular PSA test and he'll do what, a free test. And I just wondered what the difference between them was, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Elevated PSA, multiple negative biopsies. Yes, I follow those patients along, depending on the patient, sometimes every 6 to 9 months, and repeat a PSA and a rectal examination. If things are going the same, if the patient doesn't have any change in symptoms, if his PSA is stable and the rectal exam is good, I don't think we need to, you know, biopsy every year. I would biopsy if things are changing. Hey, the prostate feels a little bit different, or the PSA has bumped up. I know I have patients in my practice who have had who have PSAs in the teens, 13, 14, and have had four biopsies by four different urologists in the past, and no one has diagnosed them with prostate cancer, and we just keep an eye on them. Free and total PSA. PSA, when it is spit out of the prostate, it can do one of two things. Either it can stay in the bloodstream by itself, which means it's free, or it can bind to albumin. And we have the ability now to measure the free component of the PSA and the total PSA, and we can express the percent free. So if the free is one and the four is, if the free is one and the bound is four, then total is five, and one out of five or 20%, that's your percent free. If the percent free is low, under 10%, then the risk for cancer is almost 60%. If the percent free is above 25 or 26%, then the chance of cancer is 8%. The problem with free and total PSA is that most people fall in the middle range, and the test really doesn't help us that much because the risk for cancer is about the same as having a risk of an elevated PSA.
Mm. And in another question about prostate cancer, in terms of treatment, is there very much difference between the results that you get if you do a surgical removal of the prostate? Compare that with radiation treatment, prostate stays in place.
Well, I think no other modality has the long-term survival that radical prostatectomy has. Mm-hmm. There's definitely risks to having a radical prostatectomy or a robotic prostatectomy, but the survival benefit, no one has caught up to that yet. Not radiation, not brachytherapy, not cryoablation. So there is an advantage there, But that operation was reserved for men in their 50s, 50 to 70. Now, for a guy in his 70s, radiation therapy is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. It doesn't have the 20-year survival that surgery does, but maybe in someone who's in his upper 70s, we're not really concerned about, you know, will we get this guy to 95 by doing this?
Yeah. Just maybe one other really quick question for people who perhaps have this complaint of having to get up frequently during the night to urinate. Now, maybe some people would say, well, that's no big deal. I get up and I go back to sleep. Is there some number of times at which you say, well, okay, that maybe is excessive and maybe there's something we can do?
Well, it depends. It depends on the patient. I mean, that's a very common complaint that we get also. A lot of times, everyone blames, oh, it's on the prostate. That's the prostate's problem. And there are many other factors that get involved into waking up. How effectively does the heart pump? Does the patient have some leaky blood vessels where fluid leaks out into the legs during the day? And then when he lies flat, the fluid goes back into the bloodstream, and then the kidneys say, hey, extra fluid, let's get rid of it, and boom, at night he makes extra urine. So there are other factors involved there.
So it sounds like it might, depending on how serious an issue is, it might be just something you'd want to talk about.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I guess that's a good place for us to stop, with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Ronald Conchanan. He's a urologist from Carl Physician Group in Urbana. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.